case 21-1037, Edward Barrios Garcia versus DHS et al., 21-1056, Duplass Arzuzio versus DHS, 21-1063, Ardiles Mendez et al. Versus DHS, and 21-5022, Sudhaven Patel et al. Versus Tracy Renald. Oral argument, 30 minutes per side. Mr. Banias for the appellants.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brad Banas, and I, along with my co-counsel, James Betzold, represent the appellants in these consolidated cases. This court should reverse and remand the lower court decisions because the appellants here have stated with non-conclusory specific facts plausible claims that are well within this court's jurisdiction. And for those reasons, this court should reverse and remand these cases back to both the Western District of Michigan and the Eastern District of Kentucky. The appellant's primary claim in front of the court is an unreasonable delay claim under the Administrative Procedure Act related to a thing called the U status waiting list. The U status waiting list is a creature of regulation that was created in 2007 because the agency decided it was taking too long to get to U visas. And it is a very different benefit than the actual U visa. U visas are capped per year at 10,000. The U status waiting list is different. It has no cap, and it's created for people who are eligible for U visas, but they've run out of numbers. It's a significant benefit to our appellants. It provides work authorization, and more importantly, it provides protection from physical removal from the country, a thing called deferred action. If any of our appellants were actually outside of the country, derivatives, it would also provide a way for them to enter the United States lawfully through a thing called parole. Again, this is the agency's interpretation of its own statute, done through notice and comment rulemaking, codified at 8 CFR 214.14D2. and it's taking the agency an unreasonable amount of time to do this. So going to the two different grounds, the different cases dismissed our claims on, the first one would be jurisdiction. And that's controlled essentially for, the waiting list claim. By Norton versus SUA. I'll just refer to it as SUA.
The purpose of your case is to show that the district courts have jurisdiction to entertain these claims, right? That's the main gist of what we're into.
It's more than that, maybe.
But then, anyway, that's the first hurdle you've got to get over.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
And for this, we had two claims in all the complaints. The first one was for pre-waiting list work authorization, and I'm talking about the second claim, the U status waiting list. To establish jurisdiction, Your Honor, we look at the SUA case from the United States Supreme Court. What they say is if you can allege a agency action that is, quote, discrete and required, then the court can entertain that claim. And we've done that for the U status waiting list. And I would say a vast majority of the district courts in the country have agreed with that. I would suggest that the decisions out of the Western District of Michigan, and I should be clear, there's four cases here. Three of them are out of the Western District of Michigan. They are, for all intents and purposes, identical decisions from the same judge on the same day, just three different cases. And then there's a decision out of the Eastern District of Kentucky, which did find jurisdiction over this claim, but then said we didn't state a claim. But of course we have to show jurisdiction as a threshold issue to get to any of these.
So the jurisdiction for the waitlist claim is based on what? That there's this particular regulation, 214.14D2, is that it?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that's one of the sources. That's what identifies it as a required action under SUA. Because what that regulation says is if you're eligible, but there's not one of those 10,000 U visas available to you, you must, and that's a quote from the regulation, you must be placed on the waiting list. The next sentence says if you're placed on the waiting list, you shall be issued work authorization or parole, or excuse me, deferred action or parole. And then the next sentence gives them the ability to acquire work authorization.
But so the work authorization is discretionary, is that correct?
It is. They may grant it. As a matter of course, because this waiting list mechanism has been in place for the last decade, we don't see very many denials of work authorization.
Is there anything either under the regulation or any of the cases that you have cited to that that address or define the parameters of an unreasonable time, or what is a reasonable period in which to hold these, to leave people on the waiting list without making some kind of definitive decision?
Your Honor, there's no statutory deadline. There's no regulatory deadline. The closest thing we've gotten to is a case out of the District of South Carolina called Solis. That's a unique case in the U status case law, because after we defeated the motion to dismiss in that case, the agency actually defended and went through with summary judgment. So we got records an agreement. Instead of doing full-blown discovery, we agreed to have a declaration from the agency's head and then a deposition, a 30B6 deposition of him. And the judge down in South Carolina looked at that, and she decided that 15 months, after 15 months, based on their testimony, that's when a waitlist decision should have been made. 15 months. And she analyzed that based on background checks and agency resources, to the extent they discussed them or they knew about them. And so that, I think, is the closest thing, Your Honor, to a determination of a deadline. And I wouldn't...
Gonzalez case, your best case? Are you depending upon that?
Your Honor...
it doesn't make a difference in your case?
Well, Gonzalez, again, going to the waitlist claim, I think it's right on point. It's not a difficult question of jurisdiction or of failure to state a claim. I mean, the Gonzalez opinion, which is a case I argued, it's a 30-page decision, and the first 28 pages reject our pre-waiting list work authorization. The last two pages say, no, of course this has to go back. There's questions of fact here. It's footnote 10 that says this is a discrete and required action. And again, the court spent the first 28 pages describing exactly what discrete and required meant. and so it disabused this notion of a lack of jurisdiction in a footnote. And then the rest of it said, look, we understand the agency's claiming it has a rule of reason, but there's so much unknown. We don't know if they apply it. And I would note, because we're just discussing the Solis case, when we won that in South Carolina, we also lost the Gonzalez case in North Carolina. They went up on appeal together. The government appealed Solis. I appealed Gonzalez. They got not necessarily consolidated for argument, but they were going to be argued back to back. And then USCIS withdrew the Solis appeal. And so one of the things that's not stated in that Gonzalez case, but was during argument, was the court looked at Solis and said, look, you couldn't even prove the facts at summary judgment that you're claiming to be able to prove in your motion to dismiss. And I think that was a major part of that decision. And I think that, again, looking at all of these cases are just dismissed way too early. It cannot be decided at 12B6 when what is unreasonable, Your Honor, is fact intense. It's fact intense because, for example, I'm sure there were some of these in the Sixth Circuit, a decade ago, but there were extreme delays based on the laws passed from 9/11. They're called terrorism-related admissibility grounds. And the agencies were delaying things for 8 and 10 years at a time. And they were having great success in these appeals. And they learned this strategy of moving the dismiss and using these facts and never having to prove up the facts behind it. And now in these cases, we're getting there. We're having that ability to, through FOIA, through the limited litigation, and we're seeing that 12B6 is inappropriate. But I should say those Trigg cases, in some of those cases, they would defend on the individual facts, and they would say, look, this guy has some problems. It wasn't just a programmatic defense. And so there were individualized things about one particular application that may take 7 years or 4 years because they were from a particular country and there were exceptions and this, that, and the other. That's not how they're defending these cases in the use status. They just defend the program. And so now the relevant facts we need are about the program. How many adjudicators do they have? How long does it take? Is there a rule of reason? How does this new policy that we brought to the court's attention impact the waiting list determinations? We don't know. And that's why I think, Your Honor, you bring up Gonzalez, I think that's a very good opinion for us, because it says a claim of unreasonable delay is necessarily fact-dependent and thus sits uncomfortably at the motion to dismiss stage and should not typically be resolved at that stage. I also find it interesting in Judge Caldwell's opinion, the Patel case in front of you, she noted that there's no records in these cases. And so we would have to get the discovery because this is not a challenge of a denial of final agency action. It's a challenge of a delay. And so discovery would be appropriate. And then she goes on to say, but you know, looking at the government's claims and its motion to dismiss, we don't think you've stated a claim. And I think those two things are uncomfortable. How can you say you need discovery to prove your claim? You've made these allegations, but we're not going to accept them, you know, in the light most favorable to plaintiffs. And I think that's the error that's been made below.
What bothers me on a practical standpoint, assuming that we have jurisdiction and it goes into district court, these people who are litigating, do they get pushed up to the front of the line and that pushes somebody else behind them? And it seems like just a terrible situation going on here.
Well, Your Honor, I think the metaphor of a line is very powerful and intuitive. But in Solis, the judge said they couldn't prove they did it in a first-in, first-out basis. They did not have the facts to support their claim that they had a line. And while it, again, I say intuitive, it seems like it would be harder for the agency not to decide these one in, one out, you know. But I think that's what's happening. But we just don't know.
But isn't the basic philosophical problem, if we're saying that there's an unreasonable delay that affects everybody, then aren't we saying that the government, the executive branch, has to allocate more resources to this particular program? And is that the role of the judiciary?
I don't think that's a necessary conclusion of them taking too long. For example, in the Solis case, the government made points that they had reconfigured how the applications came in and went to adjudicators. And that was the single biggest increase, or I should say decrease, in processing times. It wasn't additional resources, Your Honor. It was something they chose to do on a management side, and it sped things up. We also don't know if resources are an issue. One of the things I cited in my reply, Your Honor, are results that are publicly available, judicially noticeable, from a FOIA request we did. And it indicates that it takes 3.74 hours. In 2018, it took 3.74 hours to adjudicate a U status waiting list and the derivatives. They had 87 adjudicators based on a deposition that we did in the Solis case. If you do the math based on 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, they had the resources, Your Honor, the resources to adjudicate 45,000 petitions. The actual number they adjudicated was about 21,000. And so, again, at this stage in the case, Your Honor, at this stage in the case, that is a specific, non-conclusory allegation that gets us an answer, not a dismissal. We've stated a plausible claim. If they have the resources to do twice as many applications as they did, there's something else going on, and it's not a resource issue, Your Honor, or at least we don't know. And maybe after discovery, we'll find out it is and we'll lose. But we're not even getting that opportunity. And I would note, what we typically see is if we defeat the motion to dismiss, the agency moots out the case by awarding waitlist. We saw one in North Carolina, in the Middle District of North Carolina, where we defeated a motion to dismiss, and the agency settled out 81 waitlist decisions. 81. And so that's their strategy. That's fine. I'm not suggesting there's anything nefarious about that strategy, but we just got to get to that point. And I think the Fourth Circuit's opinion, that last three pages, is very telling, because it's such a simple analysis. It's very straightforward. And, you know, the lower courts, I should say the court in Michigan, started citing the law for a different immigration benefit called adjustment of status. Adjustment of status is a very different creature in immigration than a U status visa application. And I would suggest it's so different. It has discretion built in. There are separate statutes that identify it in particular. And I'm sure you guys are well aware of adjustment of status with the petitions for review in front of the Sixth Circuit. But the case law is just wholly inapposite. And I think the analysis is as simple as that three pages in Gonzalez, as well as the, again, dozens and dozens of cases around the country, anywhere from Columbus, Georgia, to Brooklyn, to San Francisco, saying, no, we have jurisdiction, and, you know, you've stated a claim, we don't know what's going to happen, but it's too early in this case to accept the government's representations of fact in its motion to dismiss, and we're not going to be tempted to accept those, and we're going to give the plaintiffs a chance. And then what you won't see on Westlaw or Lexis is summary judgment motions following that, because those cases, again, typically resolved. The one exception is the Solis case.
Other than the Gonzalez case, is there any other court of appeals that has addressed the points at issue in this case?
The Seventh Circuit addressed it in 2017, Calderon, the Calderon case. That case was done slightly differently. The delay at the time it got to appeal, so we're looking at about a year in, it was an 18-month delay. And so much shorter than the 30 to 55 months we're discussing here, as well as the volume and processing that was going on between, you know, 2014 and 2017 are different than they are today. And so I would say the Seventh Circuit's addressed it. They found jurisdiction, but they affirmed that they could not state a claim. The Fourth Circuit distinguished that case by saying, we need to know. We need to know more. We need these facts. We don't have enough. We just can't decide this at the motion to dismiss stage. And so, to my knowledge, Your Honor, those are the only two. I do believe there is there's this appeal pending. And I'll check my notes during my time, but I believe there's one more appeal pending in the circuit court.
Okay, so we've been talking about the wait list. What about the pre-wait work authorization?
Yes, Your Honor. So we believe that this court has jurisdiction over that. Of course, the Fourth Circuit disagreed, and I think they made some fundamental mistakes. I think they conflated this idea of, they defied the most recent DACA case, and they basically said, well, this statute makes this benefit discretionary at the end of the day. The final eligibility determination is discretionary. And they took that discretion and said, because the final eligibility criteria includes discretion, we don't have jurisdiction over any of it. And I think it compounded that error by conflating implementation with adjudication. What we learned from the DACA case out of the Supreme Court, the Board of Regents of California, is that DACA has its eligibility criteria, an element of discretion, but the Supreme Court recognized jurisdiction to review its rescission. And so I think that's a problem with that portion of the Gonzalez decision. And I think that the Gonzalez case basically says if Congress doesn't expressly say, you must implement this benefit program, you must implement, then agencies never have a duty to implement a benefit program, even when the statute's drawn with language, with justiciably manageable standards. And so here, we have the standard as pending a bona fide. And while the government's litigation position in these cases is that language is ambiguous and who knows what it means, the most recent memo that came out defined bona fide with Black's Law Dictionary, a pretty standard way to define it that has been our argument. That's how it should be defined from the get-go. So we would say that this court, we satisfy, again, Norton v. Sua by identifying a required and discrete action because the plain language of that statute is written in such a way that Congress gave the agency, yes, discretion to decide yes or no, but also with plain terms that everyone understands that are judicially enforceable. And under the Administrative Procedure Act, 701A1 or 2, excuse me, that's sufficient.
Which one of the APA are you referring to?
I am referring to 701A2, the portion that says committed to agency discretion. And I'll just note, the standard there in the Sixth Circuit, they say it's a very, very, very narrow exception. And if there is law to apply and meaningful standards, then that's enough. The agency also argues that 701A1, that's the provision that says if a statute precludes judicial review, also bars it, and that's through the operation of another statute in the Immigration and Nationality Act, which says 8 U.S.C. 1252A2B2, that says any decision that Congress has specified is in the discretion of the Attorney General or Department of Homeland Security is not reviewable. And so they cite that one word, may, in 1184P6, and say, look, it's may. It's discretionary, no review. The problem with that is controlled by a United States Supreme Court case called Kukana, K-U-C-A-N-A. And what Kukana says is the presumption of judicial review is so strong that we're not going to trigger 1252A2B2 if the statute is capable of divergent interpretations. The agency's own brief argues for two different meanings of the word may in that statute. It says that it controls implementation. They may implement this work authorization. And they also say it controls an eligibility criteria. Once they implement it, they may grant or not grant. And so the fact that they're arguing for two different interpretations of the same word is evidence under Kukana that 1252A2B2 simply doesn't apply here. And
isn't may almost always a discretionary word?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how are they being inconsistent with themselves?
Because they're saying that may, they essentially may means they may implement the program or they may grant a petition. They're ascribing discretion to two different actions through that one little word. And what I will absolutely agree to is that the final determination of pre-waiting list work authorization is discretionary because they may grant it. What I'm disputing is that when Congress writes a statute with judicially meaningful standards, such as bona fide and pending, that everyone understands, that aren't ambiguous and gives no room for interpretation, that is not discretionary. And so that's the dispute we have. And again, under Kukana, trying to trigger that statutory preclusion, if there's divergent meanings, then it's reviewable and it's enforceable. And of course, you know, we do have this most recent action of the agency coming in and issuing this new policy memo. We provided a letter brief to the court. I tried to be concise about whether that portion of our case is moot. Our simple argument is this: our clients don't have it. They haven't accorded pre-waiting list work authorization to any of the appellants here. And so this court can still make an order that says give that to them. It's been unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed. The second thing is in footnote 7 of the announcement of the policy, and then if you read the appendix to the policy that's in their policy manual, they make clear they don't have to do this. This is a matter of grace. We are not required to do this. And so that's still a dispute. And I'll just note that it is not gone through notice and comment rulemaking. This is a mere policy memo published online in the policy guide. And we saw last week a judge in Texas invalidate a similar policy memo with a much longer history and a much more built-up infrastructure in the DACA case. And with that, Your Honors, I will...
I was wondering if there'd been any effort to settle this. I'd think the government would realize these are essential people if they're witnesses in cases or victims and should be moved along rather than put however many, you said 87 people studying it. They need a whole lot more.
Your Honor, this is a delay case. I get hired to help someone who's been waiting way too long. We try every step of the way to resolve it as quickly as possible. And I think the government has reasons it wants to defend these cases, and I can understand that having been on that side of the courtroom. But to date, we have not been able to reach a resolution. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Veit, and I am representing the United States government today. I am here with my colleague, Monique Peoples. We are both representing, obviously, the United States government today. As appellants have stated, this case essentially raises two issues. Appellants have focused on one, so the government will today as well. In their briefs, appellants indicated that the government is under a duty to implement a pre-waitlist work authorization program, and they did make some extensive arguments there. But as we can focus on today, the second claim is that USCIS, the agency here, has unreasonably delayed appellants' pre-waitlist work authorization as well as their waitlist placement. The government's position is respectfully that the courts lack jurisdiction over those claims under the APA and the Immigration and Nationality Act. and also that plaintiffs have failed to state a plausible claim for relief. I will be arguing today, making the jurisdictional arguments today, to the extent that the courts want me to focus less on the jurisdictional arguments and my colleague to stand up. She will be focusing on the 12B6 claim and whether plaintiffs or appellants have stated a plausible claim under the APA.
Can I just ask you to just make sure that you keep your voice up? You have a fairly soft voice.
Yes, Your Honor, I will, and I will try to drink water as well because sometimes I start to lose my voice as I speak. As a preliminary matter, as Appellant's Counsel noted, on June 14, 2021, USCIS did implement a new program, the Bona Fide Determination, or BFD process, EAD process, and through that process, USCIS will now be issuing employment authorization to documents to individuals prior to placement on the wait list. And that program is applicable to individuals who had U visa petitions pending prior to June 14, 2021, as well as individuals who file after June 14, 2021. So to the extent that appellants argued in their brief that USCIS is under a duty to implement a pre-waitlist program based on 8 U.S.C. 1184 P6, the government's position is that claim, the duty to implement claim, is moot now that USCIS has implemented such a program. The government's position is that it is moot without exception. It is not capable of repetition yet evading review. In this case, the government issued a policy alert and then also updated their policy manual. And in those documents, USCIS made clear that the reason for the program is the drastic volume of U visa filings and the consequent backlog that has resulted in the volume of U visa filings. So the government exercised its discretion under 8 U.S.C. 1184 P6 to implement this new BFD EAD policy.
This hasn't affected these individuals who are before us yet. Correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. So the government's position is simply that to the extent appellants argued in their brief that USCIS is under a duty to implement a pre-waitlist work authorization program, that particular claim is moot because USCIS has now implemented such a program. The government does not dispute that plaintiffs' claims for unreasonable delay are still live before this court.
You say that the lack of policy that the appellants agreed is not capable of repetition. Could the policy that USCIS has implemented, if a different administration were at the helm, couldn't they rescind that, alter that policy and replace it with a different policy that might again, disenfranchise this universe, not the people who are here now, but other potential people in that position?
Thank you, Your Honor. So the government, as mentioned, the government implemented this policy, though, because of something that has been going on with the U visa program for quite some time, as Appellant's Counsel noted, and that is just a drastic volume of filings and then a consequent backlog that has resulted. So the government's motive in implementing this particular program is, while there are a few, but it is primarily the backlog and the volume of adjudication.
That's driving the decision. I mean, that drove the implementation of the policy.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So it is the government's position that since this has been sort of formally implemented pursuant to a statute, 1184 P6, that it is a very formal policy and that it is not likely capable of repetition yet evading review. So unless the court has any other questions on the mootness issue, I can move on to the unreasonable delay claims. So the government's position is respectfully that the court lacks jurisdiction over appellant's claims that USCIS has unreasonably delayed both the pre-waitlist employment authorization program and the waitlist placement. And that is true. Appellants bring that claim under the APA 5 USC 706-1, which, as appellant's counsel has noted, requires a discrete agency action that the agency is required to take. And the government's position is that that is not true in this case. This is a discretionary action.
Well, your opponent in the oral argument has focused us on this 8 CFR 214.14D2. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. So since the Immigration and Nationality Act does not address the wait list, USCIS implemented regulations in 2007, and that is 214.14D2, and that is the waitlist adjudication that appellant's counsel notes. And while that regulation states that USCIS must place individuals on the waitlist if they have a bona fide application, U visa petition pending, it does not prescribe any time frames, nor does the Immigration and Nationality Act for the pace of such adjudication. So the government's position is that there is a distinction between a claim that USCIS has simply refused to place U visa petitioners on the wait list and a claim that USCIS has unreasonably delayed such action, which is appellant's claim here.
Isn't there a reasonableness requirement inferred when you have a regulation that says all eligible petitioners must be placed on a waiting list, that something will be done within a reasonable amount of time?
Your Honor, I guess the government's position there is that reasonableness, the agency is sort of in the best position, since this is discretionary, to determine what is reasonable. There is nothing in the Immigration and Nationality Act that prescribes any time frame for waitlist adjudication. And 214.14D2 also does not set forth any time frame for the agency. And there are a lot of factors that go into reasonableness, and of course my co-counsel will also discuss this when she comes up, but the agency is in the best position to allocate its resources and determine what is reasonable based on sort of the nuances of the U visa program. So to that, I guess the government's position is just that the courts are not necessarily able to intervene, since there are no meaningful standards for them to look at as to what is a reasonable pace of adjudication. And the agency is then in the best position to make that determination based on various factors.
What's the status of these people who are wanting to get on the wait list? Are they illegal aliens, or they have some kind of a legality in this country? I don't understand it fully on this.
Your Honor, my understanding, though I don't know their status today, and appellant's counsel may be able to address this better, but my understanding is that these individuals do not have status at this time.
Are they in the United States, or are they in other countries?
In this case, they are in the United States.
In the U.S., but they can't work legally.
Unless they have some other status, that would be true, yes, for anyone
who would wait around all this long period of time. What did they do during that time? Just illegally work or have somebody to support them? It sounds like a terrible situation.
Certainly, and the government recognizes that for individuals who don't have lawful status, which many individuals who file U visa petitions do not, some of the benefits of that program are status, that it is a difficult position to be in, as is any individual who is present in the country without lawful status. And recognizing the sort of difficulty that U visa petitioners who don't have status have, the government has made efforts to try to eliminate the backlog. For example, in 2016, the government added an additional service center to adjudicate these U visa petitions. And most recently, obviously, in June 2021, the government implemented this BFD EAD program. So the government does recognize that it is difficult to be present in the United States without lawful status and is making its best efforts to adjudicate these U visa petitions through this BFD EAD policy and also adding some additional resources to the program. But the volume of filings is still large, and so the backlog does remain.
But you're here arguing that we don't even have jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor. As to the pre-waitlist work authorization claim, the government's position is that 1184P6 is clear on its face, that courts, that it is discretionary. That statute provides that USCIS may grant work authorization to individuals with a pending bona fide U visa petition. And relevant today is also the Immigration and Nationality Act, 8 USC 1252A2B2, which states that the courts lack jurisdiction over actions of the Secretary of Homeland Security that are committed to its discretion. And because 1184P6 specifically states that USCIS may grant work authorization, it is the agency's position that particularly pre-waitlist adjudications are committed to the agency's discretion.
If I could interrupt, 1252 is talking about judicial review of orders of removal. Is that what you're referring to?
We are referring to 8 USC 1252A2B2,
yeah.
Which states that, yes, which refers to discretionary decisions specifically. So that states that the INA precludes judicial review over any decision or action of the Secretary of Homeland Security, the authority for which is specified under this chapter to be in the discretion of the Secretary of Homeland Security. So that particular section refers to discretionary decisions or actions.
Okay, so even though the heading of 1252 is judicial review of orders of removal, we don't have orders of removal here, correct?
That's correct.
But you're saying that A2...
Yes, that 1252A2B2 refers to, yeah, decisions or actions.
Those broader than removal actions?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What case would you send us to verify that?
Your Honor, the court's Butanda v. Holder, I'm sorry if I'm saying that incorrectly.
You can try saying it again so I can hear it, I'm sorry.
Butanda.
Butanda,
yes, let's see, let me make sure I spell it correctly for you.
And is that a Supreme Court case or something, some other court?
No, Your Honor, but I can discuss the Kuchana or Kutana case that appellants counsel have mentioned as well.
It would seem to counter or at least weaken your argument.
So the Supreme Court's case in Kuchana or Kuchana v. Holder, in that case, the court held that the jurisdictional provision at 8 USC 1252A2B2 is applicable only where a statute precludes judicial review. So that case does make clear that that it is a discretionary provision. It deals with decisions or actions of the Attorney General, but that 1252A2B2 is triggered only where a statute is at issue and not a regulation. So in that case, it was dealing with a regulation of the Board of Immigration Appeals, dealing with motions to reopen. CFR 1003, and the court determined in that case that 1252A2B2 was not triggered because it was a regulation, but that this jurisdiction stripping provision does apply to statutes that make agency action, that commit agency action to the agency's discretion.
This is a very confusing area of law, so I apologize if I'm making a misstatement. But it seems to me that the waiting list provision in the regulation here orders that all eligible petitioners must be placed on a waiting list, and that would then indicate that this is not a discretionary decision, that it must be done, and that the only question is whether there's unreasonable delay or not, which seems to me to be a question of stating a claim as opposed to jurisdiction. Can you, I know your goal is to tell us that we don't have jurisdiction, so tell me where I am wrong on that.
So, Your Honor, the government does not dispute that under 214.14d2, the government is required, USCIS is required to determine whether an individual is eligible for waitlist placement. But as the Western District of Michigan stated in the lower court, in these cases, there is a distinction between the duty or the refusal to adjudicate and the pace of adjudication. And here the issue is the pace of adjudication. So, and it is the government's position that the pace of adjudication is left to the agency's discretion. And that is because there is no congressionally mandated timeline. And we have seen that Congress knows how to impose a timeline on USCIS adjudications when it wants to. For example, 8 U.S.C. 1447B naturalization applications require the agency to adjudicate those applications within 120 days of an interview. So,
what is that section again, please?
8 U.S.C. 1447B. And that deals with naturalization applications and requires the agency to adjudicate those applications within 120 days. And that is true throughout, again, the INA, that where Congress does want to impose some type of statutory time frame on USCIS, it does so. There are other places, even in 1184, which governs the admission of non-immigrants, where Congress has imposed a statutory time frame. 1184C2C, dealing with L1 intercompany transferees, which I will not get into details, as I'm not an expert as well, but Congress didn't impose a 30-day time frame on the agency for adjudication there, as with 8 U.S.C. 1184C6D. And the district court in, I believe, Urenga recognized that it's clear that even in this particular statute, 1184, Congress has shown that it knows how to impose a specific time frame on the agency when it wants to. So here, we don't have a statute that specifically addresses the waitlist placement. I would like to just note that 8 U.S.C. 1184A1 governs the admission of all non-immigrants. Let me make sure I state it correctly. But 1184A1 states that the admission to the United States of any alien as a non-immigrant shall be for such time and under such conditions as the Secretary of Homeland Security may by regulations prescribe. So 1184.1, which governs the admission of non-immigrants in general, provides the Secretary with broad discretion over the admission of non-immigrants. That statute, combined with 1184.P6, dealing with the U visa program, indicate that, and stating may, indicate that this decision has been left to USCIS's discretion. So, with the respect to the claim for unreasonable delay regarding the waitlist placement program, the government would just like to emphasize that there is a difference between the refusal to adjudicate, which we certainly acknowledge that the agency is required to determine whether someone is eligible for waitlist placement, but also the pace of adjudication. And since there is no congressionally mandated time frame here, and no standards for which courts can determine what a reasonable time frame is, it is best up to USCIS to allocate its own resources and determine what the appropriate time frame is. And mindful of my time, unless the court has any additional questions about jurisdiction, I will turn it over to my co-counsel, Ms. Peoples.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Again, my name is Monique Peoples, and I will discuss the plaintiff's failure to state a valid claim for relief should the court find that subject matter jurisdiction exists. In all four of the cases below, the court held that plaintiffs failed to satisfy 12b6 standards. And in all of those cases, the court was right. As an initial matter, I'd like to address the plaintiff's argument that their unreasonable delay claims are not appropriate for 12B6 resolution. That argument lacks merit. Plaintiffs fail to cite any case, and we are not aware of any, that categorically exempts unreasonable delay claims from 12B6 consideration.
Counsel, for the appellants, in his argument, mentioned that in some of these cases below, the 12B6 determination, I guess, really was almost premature because I know that 12B6 relates to the face of the pleadings. He was saying that in many of these instances, there was no opportunity for, you know, to discover documentation that might help them make a different facial statement in the complaints. How do you respond to that? Or do you see that as a non-issue and not really applicable at the 12B6 level?
Well, for a couple responses there. First, the Supreme Court has discussed the motivating factors behind the rule, which is that it recognized that litigation is expensive, discovery is burdensome, and courts shouldn't unlock the doors to discovery for a plaintiff armed with nothing more than conclusory allegations. And so that's what's happened here. And in fact, numerous courts, including the district courts below, have actually dismissed unreasonable delay claims on 12B6 motions. We've cited a couple in our briefs, but the Muminov case, Al-Khasab, and Shalka cases, they have all found that unreasonable delay claims are appropriate for 12B6 resolution and have dismissed those claims as failing to state or to satisfy those standards.
Does the Twombly decision alter that in any way with the imposition of that plausibility standard?
I would argue that the Iqbal and the Twombly decisions actually support the positions here because they make clear that a complaint that tenders naked assertions or that devoid of further factual enhancement won't satisfy the standard, and that the court is not bound to accept as true a legal conclusion couched as a factual allegation, and that if the complaint is deficient, plaintiff's not entitled to discovery, whether or not that discovery is cabined or otherwise limited. And here, that those considerations are applied with equal force. And again, plaintiff's counsel makes a lot of the Solis decision. That case is reliance on that case is misplaced. In Solis, the district court found that dismissal was improper because the complaint there satisfied 12B6 standards, not because the motion was premature. And the court gives very little to no analysis as to why the complaint there was found sufficient, but it just said that it did. But even still, the ruling there and that court's determination there doesn't undermine the district court's contrary conclusions here. These are different complaints. And notably, in Solis, the central to that complaint was the allegation that CIS had stopped making waitlist adjudications altogether, that the plaintiff's wait time was beyond the published processing times, and that their applications had been processed and were ready for adjudication is simply just sitting on the shelf. None of those allegations are in this case at all. So what if
a complaint says that the person's case has been pending for 5 years? Would that be enough to state a claim?
No, and cases say that just the passage of time alone is insufficient to state a unreasonable delay claim. There are numerous factors go into the consideration, and if I may, I can move on to discussing what we deem as the most important and the most dispositive factor in this case. But I do want to make clear that the court can and should at this stage decide whether or not the plaintiff's complaints have met the plausibility standard, and here the district court's made the determination and it was proper.
Well, you said no for 5 years. So what if a plaintiff's complaint says that it's been pending for 10 years? Would that be enough to state a plausible claim?
Again, the cases say on its face, just the mere passage of time alone is not a sufficient reason state an unreasonable delay claim.
How could 10 years not be an unreasonable delay?
Well, none of the cases here involve a 10-year delay.
No, but I'm asking you a hypothetical. I'm just trying to figure out why some extreme number of months or years wouldn't be enough to state a plausible claim of unreasonable delay.
Without knowing more about the hypothetical you're providing, it's not clear as to what complexity goes into the agency determination, the resources. I mean, they're just whether or not the rule that they employ in their adjudication process is reasonable.
How would a plaintiff know those facts about the resources and so forth? That's all within the agency's knowledge. That's not within some individual's knowledge. They know, and my hypo, I understand it's a hypo, they know it's been 10 years that they have been waiting to be put on the waiting list or to get a U visa.
Well, in this case, and I think as plaintiff's counsel has acknowledged, I mean, these are delays that are publicly, now, like the public knows about them. They're published on the agency's website, and certainly
it
in this case.
If just the public knows that there have been extraordinary delays of 10 years in my hypo, I understand it's a hypo. It doesn't make it reasonable, it makes it known, but that's all.
It may, but going to your question to know for the plaintiff to submit this application and have some type of insight as to how long it will take. In this case, CIS has published processing times on its website, so an applicant can go in and see at the time that they submit their application how long the agency is currently estimating that the time it will take to process the application. And again, in this case. In the complaints, they all alleged that their time, at the time they filed the complaint, was within the normal published processing times.
So does CIS, by publishing that the normal wait time, hypothetically, is 10 years, would that preclude then anyone whose application was less than 10 years from saying it's an unreasonable delay?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that's a factor. It's certainly a relevant factor and something to be considered along with the other track factors. And I will say here, going to it, we're sympathetic. We understand that people are waiting. But currently the list has 261,000 applications. That's what CIS is faced with. And the number of applications are simply outpacing the number of adjudications. It's a very, very long time. It's a very complex adjudication process that the agency takes very seriously. And here it is not simply a case where the agency is twiddling its thumbs. It has taken significant and meaningful steps to try to alleviate the backlog. As Ms. Veit mentioned earlier, in 2016, the agency created a second service center to process these applications. Just this year, the agency created a new program to try to deal with and address the backlog, which is the BFDEAD policy, and that is expected to alleviate a lot of the backlog here. But I will point that even if the court found that the delay was unreasonable, which we contend that it's not, that alone doesn't justify judicial intervention. Doing so would intrude into the agency's allocation of its scarce resources, which respectfully courts are ill-equipped to address. CIS is in its best position to consider its the many variables at play, prioritize its own priorities, and use its expertise to determine how to allocate its resources. And numerous courts in the U visa context have upheld delays similar to or that exceed the delays in this case. For example,
can you, since you said that you couldn't say just with the facts of Judge Moore's hypothetical alone that would be unreasonable today, can you envision a period of time that might that you believe might constitute unreasonable delay? And I know you told us about the processing information that's available to the public, but can you come up with an out of bound period that might be considered to be unreasonable? I'm not asking you to speak now, for the agency, but I want you to respond and give us your own hypothetical.
Your Honor, I cannot, as I stand here today, give a definite time. All I know is that that the courts, the Seventh Circuit, upheld a 2-year delay in a U visa context. District courts have upheld 4-year delays. Recently, the Eastern District of New York has upheld a nearly 6-year delay. And again, this was in the U visa context, and that's in the NN case.
And then there's that case that counsel for the appellants mentioned where a court in South Carolina said that something less than 2 years was unreasonable, correct?
Yeah, and again, that's the Solis case.
Yes.
And in notably there, again, that was, as I've already discussed, a completely different case, completely different allegations. But the the District of South Carolina in the Alcosab case made a different contrary finding where it did dismiss an unreasonable delay claim, finding that construing all the facts in the plaintiff's favor, CIS's adjudication of an asylum application was not unreasonably delayed, and it did so because compelling action on that complaint would really move the plaintiff to the front of the line unfairly and push everyone else back.
But that court did find that they had jurisdiction to review, to exercise judicial review in that situation and make that determination.
It did in that instance. And as Ms. Veit discussed, in, you know, reasons why this case is, that case was wrong on that count. But discussing all of the factors and the fact that CIS has a rule of reason, as numerous courts have already held, and that here the fourth factor is very dispositive, where it is that plaintiffs are really seeking to be moved to the head of the line in front of everyone else. And that was unfair, and it only rewarded those with resources to sue to the detriment of everyone else. So respectfully, there are numerous cases out there that have upheld delays much longer than the ones here. And again,
But your position, on the one hand, you say you're going to fault the plaintiffs because they're trying to move to the head of the line. And on the other hand, you say the courts can't force the government to devote more resources so that they can speed everybody up. And so therefore, you're saying that we have to be happy with unreasonable delays and leave it to the CIS in their discretion to decide how long it's going to take to get relief.
Again, we're very sympathetic and we're not cavalier about the delay and the situation the plaintiffs are in, but what we are saying is that this is an issue that courts have historically left to the agency's expertise to determine how best to shift and prioritize their resources in light of the backlog. And again, let's note that just this year, just last month, the agency implemented a new program to help alleviate the backlog. And so we feel like that is very important factor here. And given that the agency has taken these meaningful steps to alleviate its own backlog, that the courts should not intervene.
How will that new program impact these four people?
Well, what it should do is actually impact everyone that's waiting for U visa adjudication. It really should shorten the amount of time it takes to get to them on this list. And so that, again, should impact not only these plaintiffs, but everyone else who's waiting in line for U visa adjudication.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Honors. I will just 3 points. Timelines are not required to state an unreasonable delay. You don't have to have a statutory timeline, regulatory timeline. Thank goodness in the 1930s, they had the foresight to pass the Administrative Procedure Act, which acts as the background and agency rules for the administrative state today. Simply because the INA doesn't have a deadline in it for these particular decisions, what Norton v. Sua tells us is it doesn't matter. You have to cite something that's discrete and required. If I may have misheard, but I think the government agreed that it was required to put someone on the wait list, that's a discrete action. It's not writing a land use report like they tried to do in SUA. So that's a discrete required action. That's all we've got to do to establish jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1331 with a cause of action under the Administrative Procedure Act. What dictates what's reasonable is the Administrative Procedure Act. It says under 5 U.S.C. 555B, this applies to all agencies, all agency actions, you have to make a decision within a, quote, reasonable amount of time, keeping in mind the convenience of the parties. The District of Columbia in the 70s established a set of factors called the track factors that courts typically use, though not are not required to determine what is reasonable and what is unreasonable. And so when the government argues there's no judicially manageable standard to determine what's reasonable, I think that's against the weight of the case law that says we look at these track factors. That's that. The agency cited a couple of statutes that have timelines in the Immigration and Nationality Act. I think you'll find, if you go and look at the case law under 8 U.S.C. 1447b, the agency argues that timeline's not mandatory. They don't have to make a decision within 120 days. The same thing, I can tell you, they're making the exact same argument in Seattle in a class action I'm involved in called Etta Cooney. The agency cited 1184c2 that says you have to make a decision in 30 days on a particular petition. I have a brief that was filed on Monday from the Department of Justice, from the very office that's defending this case, that says that's not mandatory, we don't have to follow it. A 9-month delay on that is completely reasonable. So this idea that timelines are required, you'll find in my, I don't like string cites, Your Honors, but in that string set of cases, they all reject that idea, that a timeline is required. What is required is that it's a reasonable amount of time. I also want to answer your hypothetical, Judge Moore. What would be, could a 10-year delay be reasonable? I think it could. What would that mean? It would mean, this is my scenario, this is my factual scenario. You, status applicant, files something. The government looks at it within that 15 months and they go, oh no, there's something going on here. They send it to the State Department, do an investigation in the person's hometown in a foreign country. They're digging around, they're looking, they find a different birth certificate. That comes back to the United States, back to the Department of Homeland Security. Department of Homeland Security starts looking into that person, looking into their family, looking for allegations of fraud, perhaps nefarious conduct. That would be constant action that could take 6 or 8 years. And in that particular situation, I can see an 8-year delay being reasonable. I would point this court to a case, I believe it's from late 2013 or 2014 out of the Eighth Circuit called Irshad, I-R-S-H-A-D, which is a case from an appellate court that A, recognized jurisdiction, but said a 8-year delay was reasonable. Very different facts than what we have here, and that's not what the government's arguing. They're saying our program is reasonable. They're not saying the particular facts of this case make Mr. Patel's 55-month wait reasonable. That's just not what's happening.
That you're really just asking to be put to the head of the line?
Your Honor, I stand by our proposition. There's no line. Let them prove there's a line. The rule...
If they did, first in, first out.
If they can demonstrate that, I don't think it's dispositive. The head of the line argument comes primarily from a case of a D.C. circuit called Mashpee. Mashpee is a case that involved the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a different BIA than what we're used to in the immigration context. The Mashpee group of people were seeking recognition as a Native American tribe so they could have certain benefits, have a reservation, that sort of thing. The organic statute that allows for that process to go forward requires 3 different types of PhDs to look at every application. It requires years and years of studies. It's essentially, I call it the equivalent of, you know, a nuclear power plant, right? And that office's resources, which were discussed in Mashpee because there was limited discovery, what we learned was that agency, the entire agency, all of its resources had to be used on one application at a time, one at a time. And there were 10 pending. So if they stopped doing the one that was at the head of the line, and they went back to number 10, the Mashpee folks, yes, those 9 people would be moved back, and they'd move back by years, because that's a sophisticated process that undisputedly took up all of the resources of that particular agency charged with doing that sophisticated analysis. That is a far cry from what we have here, where the agency has the ability. Again, I'll go back to 2018, because that's the year I know best about from the numbers we've been able to somehow get from the government. 87 adjudicators, some in Nebraska, some in Vermont. Average processing time for the U status waiting list and the derivatives, because they're all decided at the same time, 3.74 hours. They had the ability to decide 42,000 applications in a year. That is a far cry from Mashpee, where all the resources are used up. You have hundreds being able to be adjudicated in the same day. So the idea that they're being decided before others is accurate for people waiting in or with same dates of filing, but this idea that there's a line, if we accept that metaphor, then the line's gotta be 150 people wide, at least, or however many they can decide in one day. And then everyone in that spot is not just the individual, right? It's the principal applicant and their derivatives. Their derivatives could have filed 5 years after them, but they're gonna be decided at the same time. The line keeps getting put, people at the top from who are in removal proceedings, people with removal orders, people who get expedites, it's very different than the case law they cite. And that's why we argue it shouldn't be as weighty in a case like this, where they have the resources to do concurrent adjudications for hundreds of people, not Mashpee, where it's literally all the resources for one particular person. And I think I'm surprised that when I find courts that rule like that, it always goes back to that one particular case from the DC Circuit of Mashpee. I just want to note, moving on to kind of the published processing times, and then I want to address Justice Seiler's point, but when we filed this lawsuit, actually, when we filed the appeal, the processing times were, the lawsuit, 50 months. The lawsuits went pretty quickly, actually. I think we all lost in about 6 months. Last night, they're at 60 months. That would mean their delays are more reasonable now than they were when we filed the suits a year ago. The agency's use and reliance on these processing times, which it has inspector general reports from its own agency saying they are really problematic, we shouldn't trust them, is a red herring. And there's a court out of Chicago, Camarena, that has a line that gets quoted in a lot of the decisions we cite that says, if the processing times are unreasonable, they're unreasonable. if they go to a 10-year processing time, that's unreasonable for everyone involved because the bureaucracy is failing these individuals. And I feel like when we get into court and we're talking about jurisdiction and we're talking about failure to state a claim and Iqbal, we lose sight of the plaintiffs here. The Patels have been waiting for this benefit for years, 5, 6 years, the parents and the children. They can't work. They can't. They can be physically removed at any time. And what does that mean? They can't get driver's licenses lawfully. They can't pay in the taxes because they can't get a Social Security. The children can't necessarily go to school, go on to higher education, because they're waiting on a decision, just a decision from the agency. Not even an approval. If it's a denial, I've had lots of clients wait for the denial and depart the United States. It's just that finality. And I urge the court to give us a chance in the district court to make that claim and find out what's really going on so that if we can win on the facts, great. If we can't, I understand too. Thank you.
Thank you all for your argument, and the case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn court.